Bookstack with Richard Aldous, the Books and Ideas podcast brought to you by AmericanPurpose.com. Coming up on the show today, Nicholas Shakespeare, author of the new book, Ian Fleming, The Complete Man. Nicholas, welcome to Bookstack.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the new book. And of course, we know a lot about Ian Fleming's most famous creation, but what about the man himself?
Well, I'm a novelist before I'm a biographer. And 5 years ago, when I was approached by the Fleming family to write the first new authorized biography of Fleming since 1966, I was slightly hesitant because I felt, having seen Fleming, the author, only through sideways glances, I had a very rather pejorative image of him. And I suppose the moral of his story is don't run off with the wife of the owner of the Daily Mail if you wish forever after to avoid being rendered into tabloid fat, because the image I had was a tabloid caricature of a kind of wife-beating womanizer, a sardonic old Etonian, private school educated, who spent his time at the golf course or at Boodle's Club and came back home late at night, past his wife's posh friends in their London house, waving at them as he went up to his top floor monastic bedroom and put the sheets over his head to drown out the sniggers of these intellectual guests laughing at passages from his latest book. And I thought, do I really want to spend 3 or 4 years, which a biography would take, in the company of such a cad and a bounder? So I did ask for a couple of months to do some due diligence. And in that period, 2 or 3 things I found out that I hadn't expected. First of all, he was a much kinder person than I'd hitherto anticipated. And that again and again, the women who had affairs with, and as Rebecca West said, there were enough of them to fill the Albert Hall, poor dear, again and again referred to him as a kind person. I remember coming across an unpublished diary entry by Maud Russell, who he'd had a long relationship with during the war, who bought Goldeneye for him after the war, this small house in Jamaica where he wrote all the Bond books. And she said, I think of Ian and I think of his kindliness. Now, that is not a characteristic associated with James Bond. And I thought that was a very interesting, for a biographer, that's a prize quality to try and get out from the ground, especially when it's not known about. And with men, too. He had a lot of great friends, loyal friends, very upright people who would never have been taken in by a bounder. And they were loyal to him to the end of his life. And so I thought, but he's a man who's attractive to both men and women. That's interesting. Secondly, he was much more important than I'd been led to believe. My great boss at the Daily Telegraph, Max Hastings, wonderful military historian, can't be shifted from his opinion that Fleming during the war was really just in charge of in-trays, out-trays, and ash-trays, a kind of, a commander in the naval intelligence who never left his desk to do brave things like those he sent others to do. Well, this is very, very far from the truth. He was absolutely in the inner sanctum of British intelligence. People like John le Carré and Graham Greene, both authors I knew, who had mined their intelligence experience for their novels, better novelists than Ian Fleming, but not nearly so important in the intelligence circles in which they worked. I mean, le Carré, who I knew, was a minor functionary in intelligence in Hamburg with not a successful operation to his name. And Graham Greene was sent to kind of Sierra Leone during the war as an operative. These weren't what Fleming was doing. Fleming was one of only 30 ultra-cleared intelligence officers in the war, this very top secret code and deciphering information that would come from Bletchley Park. He was also somebody who set up an intelligence gathering unit called 30AU, which went ahead of the armies into northern Africa and into Sicily and into northern France and Germany to try and grab the Enigma machines and code books and cipher books to send back to Bletchley, shortening the war, some historians think, by as much as 18 months. More important for an American audience, he was sent out by Admiral Godfrey, his boss, to try and persuade America, who in 1941, incredible to believe, did not have a foreign intelligence service. They had a kind of bodyguards to guard Roosevelt was the intelligence service. Fleming was sent out to try and help set up, modeled on naval intelligence, what would become COI and then OSS, and then in 1947, the CIA. And he does this with Colonel William Donovan. They sit in Washington, in Georgetown, over several months. And Fleming, only one surviving memo of the kind of organization Fleming wanted to create survives, but it seems there were three or four memos. And Donovan and Fleming work to try and find an organization that could be modeled basically on British intelligence. And so Fleming is absolutely in the room when these important decisions are being made. And when Churchill in 1946 talks about a special relationship between England and America, this is essentially an intelligence relationship, and few people had done more to make it special than Ian Fleming. So these two things, that he was a kinder and more important person, persuaded me actually, or even though there's much written about Fleming, a bit like Churchill or Napoleon, there were still things to say that we hadn't learned, and still a character to resuscitate in a way we hadn't really expected him to be.
And I mean, that's one of the incredible things about the book and the life, that everything about his life, as you indicated there, is fascinating. He has this very interesting early life. He has this interesting war in naval intelligence, interesting career in journalism. At the Sunday Times, aside from the Bond books, he even writes Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and that's another huge success for him. Thrilling Cities, another great success. So, I mean, on every level, it's a genuinely remarkable and fascinating life, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, he dies when he's 56, and I think it's worth repeating that Bond is really an afterthought. He starts writing it when he's 43 in 1952, almost as a way of kind of warding off the impending marriage. He's been a bachelor until this moment. And Bond seems to be a way of retrieving his bachelor life during the Second World War, when he was going to bed in the Blitz with everybody and he was sending people off on dangerous missions and himself going off on one or two dangerous missions. And he was recasting the person he was in the Cold War setting. But it's happening when the rest of his life is over. I mean, his interesting life has finished. And what I found fascinating is to see how much of his life pre-Bond is so much more important and fascinating, as you say, than his Bond life. And that was a real revelation. And I think one of the problems with Fleming is that, unlike Le Carré, who was able to be a kind of custodian of his image so that we think of Le Carré before we think of George Smiley, Fleming has been drowned out by Bond. The success of Bond has kind of completely suffocated and swamped him. And the films, too, continue this to such an extent that I think one or two people in America I met said, "What, you mean their books before the films?" So Bond himself has drowned out Fleming. And one of the joys of writing this book was to actually be able to kind of retrieve Fleming as more important than Bond, and to say that actually he wouldn't have led the life he led. He couldn't have written Bond without leading the life he did. But if he hadn't written Bond, we'd still want to know about Ian Fleming, because he was in the room when all these important decisions were being made, in the room with people like President Kennedy, who was a complete Bond fan. In fact, just in the year that Kennedy is elected, he has dinner with Fleming, and he asks Fleming in Washington what Fleming would do, what Bond would do about Fidel Castro, who'd come to power in Cuba 18 months before. And Fleming bewitches Kennedy with his ideas for what Kennedy should do with Castro. Many of these ideas based on Second World War operations that he and Donovan had planned and talked about and Fleming had done. Kennedy is enraptured, tries to get hold of the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, another Bond fan, the following morning. And Dulles is having a top secret meeting to green light the operation against Castro, which would include assassination. And, you know, when the Bear Pigs takes place the following year, when Kennedy is president, it's like a bad Bond operation. And it's seen by Kennedy and by his brother Bobby Kennedy in the paradigm of a Bond story. I mean, Bobby Kennedy looks at the man who's charged with leading the Bay of Pigs invasion, and he says, "You're no James Bond." And then when it all collapses, Kennedy says, "This wouldn't have happened to 007. And it's not only Kennedy who's obsessed by Bond, and his brother, and Jackie loved the Bond books too. It's also the man who kills Kennedy. Lee Harvey Oswald became completely obsessed in the summer of 1963 and had four Bond titles in his library. The FBI find when they invade his boarding house after the assassination, they find From Russia with Love. But they also find that during that summer, Lee Oswald had called himself as an alias James after James Bond. So both Kennedy and his assassin are obsessed by James Bond. I thought that was fascinating, that, you know, he's not just a fictional character. He gets into the lives of important people.
I mean, you talked about that interesting early life as well. One of the really, I think, intriguing elements here that you bring out in the book is the family relationship. First, his father, who was a friend of Churchill, a war hero, who died before Ian Fleming was even 10 years old, and his brother, Peter, with whom he has this fascinating competitive relationship. And for most of their life, it's Peter who's the star of the family, not Ian.
It's a fascinating dynamic, slightly imitating the dynamic of Alec Waugh and Evelyn Waugh, the other two English writers who were contemporaries of Fleming and who Fleming knew. And so Alec, the elder brother, and Peter, the elder brother, before the war, are these very, very famous writers. And their younger brothers are forced into being kind of black sheep. Evelyn and Ian Fleming are forced into being kind of people that it probably wouldn't have been normally, but they have these extraordinarily talented elder brothers. And Peter Fleming was almost like Byron in the fame he had in the mid-30s when he writes Brazilian Adventure and he writes News from Tartary. He's being tipped to be the next editor of the Times or Viceroy of India. He then lands in occupied Europe, the first British officer to land in occupied Europe in Norway in April 1940. And he then goes out to India to set up the British intelligence there. He's absolutely the kipper's knickers, the most famous old attorney there's ever been. And then after the war, their roles completely change. And suddenly, it's the younger brother, Ian, and it's Evelyn Waugh writing Brideshead Revisited. Alec Waugh can't get published. Similarly with Peter, he just becomes a kind of landowner near Henley, while Ian is suddenly becoming one of the most famous writers on earth. And I think that dynamic is quite important. I think the second son is a syndrome that you see behind many. Jack Kennedy was a second son. I think that's why he and Ian understood each other, that they recognized that they were both overshadowed by a brilliant elder brother. And so all their energies went into overcoming that position.
One of the things that I always find fascinating about Fleming and the Bond novels is that there's a certain contradiction that's always at the heart of them. On the one hand, they very much seem to be looking to the past. They're projecting a certain vision of Englishness and what Englishness is, but also what it used to be. On the other hand, they're very modern novels, obsessed with gadgets and modernity and consumer society and so on. Do you think that that's part of the reason for their enduring success?
I think you brilliantly put your finger on it. Because, I mean, who knows what the magic formula is that keeps Bond alive today? Every week in the paper, every day, James Bond is a yardstick. He comes up, unlike any other fictional character. I mean, Bond is still relevant to us. Now, why is that? I don't think the filmmakers, Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, particularly understand. They know they can't tamper with it too much. But I think what you said earlier, this contradiction in Bond that allows him to be constantly fresh and protean, to be able to go into the future or the present or the past, I think it's his contradiction that he's both a hero of modernization, as you say, gadgets, and he's ahead of his time, but he's also a symbol of retrospective power. And what I found fascinating is we forget that the first five Bond books really didn't take off. They sold in America 4,000 copies, I think, and in England they never broke through what Fleming called the sound barrier of 8,000. And he's going to give up. He writes From Russia with Love, and that's going to be the last book. And you remember at the end of it that Bond is poisoned by a steel toe cap of Irma Kleb, and he falls to the floor. And we don't really know if he's going to be resuscitated. And I think Fleming, when he goes to Jamaica that year in 56, tells his editor, you mustn't expect another Bond. I don't think I'm going to do it anymore. What happens? Anthony Eden invades the Suez Canal absolutely catastrophically. It's the worst moment for Britain post-war. It's like a D-Day without American troops, without American permission. Quite quickly, Anthony Eden, old Etonian like Fleming, has a kind of breakdown and wants to go and recuperate in the middle of this crisis. And where does he choose? He chooses Goldeneye, Ian Fleming's house, this two-bedroom bungalow, where he'd conceived Bond 4 years before. On the same day that Ian Fleming is talking to the Prime Minister about the bed that he has set up for the Prime Minister in this rather primitive house in Jamaica, Ian Fleming's wife, Anne, is in bed with the leader of the opposition, Hugh Gaitskell, in a Paris hotel, which shows you how intimate they were at the center of power, that they were there when the important decisions were being made, and sometimes not only in the room, but in the bedroom. Anyway, what happens? Eden goes to Goldeneye. There are two telephones that have to be installed, and from Goldeneye, the gazebo, he is instructing, you know, the British troops to withdraw from the canal. And he's almost like a Bond villain there, sending out messages from this kind of remote bungalow to the rest of the world. Well, what happens to Eden? A bit like Kennedy, who's associated with Bond, Eden takes Ian Fleming's dinghy out into the bay, and it's got a leak. So while Eden's paddling around in the bay, he's thinking in this dinghy. Meanwhile, Bond, who was about to be kind of put underground, suddenly erupt from the bay, totally fortified. And from now on, Bond is going to be a one-man Suez force, and the lower the sun sets on the British Empire, the more radiant Bond's glow. After Suez and 1956, Bond suddenly is there, and Fleming has to go on writing it. And suddenly the film people become interested, largely through J.F. Kennedy's saying that one of his favorite books to Life magazine is From Russia with Love. So suddenly, instead of dying like Eden, you know, going under, he comes up and he becomes this icon we talk about now. But it all happened during, you know, in the mid-50s and unexpectedly.
And it's interesting that, you know, you bring up Suez and Fleming himself, as you point out, and the book is very harsh on the British about the Suez escapade. And it does seem to me to be one of the things about the novels that, you know, actually they're much harder than the film psychologically, emotionally. They're written in this very terse, driven prose. And even Le Carré, who you mentioned earlier, it strikes me that if you actually read the Fleming novels, he's often as cynical and world-weary about the Cold War and secret world as any Le Carré character, perhaps even more so.
Yes, I mean, Le Carré had a problem with Fleming, as I would often discuss with Le Carré. And I would argue to Le Carré that he had created George Smiley deliberately in opposition to Bond as a kind of middle-aged, ugly, cuckolded, morally torn intellectual, everything James Bond isn't. I mean, James Bond's only read 3 books in his life, I think. A book on golf, Kennedy's Profiles in Courage, and one other book he doesn't finish. He's absolutely not a George Smiley. But in a sense, Le Carré honed his character in opposition to someone, as you rightly say, who actually had his own cynicism about the Secret Service. I mean, one reason that Fleming wrote Casino Royale, his first book in 1952, was to restore the damaged image of the British Secret Service following the defection of Burgess, who had been at Eton with Ian Fleming, and Maclean, who defected in 1951 and weren't really seen again until 5 years later when Fleming's journalist Richard Hughes interviewed them in Moscow. But this, it's very hard to retrieve what an effect this had on the British establishment, this defection. People from within the intelligence community, private school educated, who suddenly went over to the other side. And I think Bond is written partly to cleanse the image of a damaged Secret Service. And as I say, he becomes a one-man Suez task force. He's in the tradition of people like Bulldog Drummond and Richard Hannay, kind of, you know, great single heroes who can alter the course of a nation's trajectory. And I think that's why Kennedy loved Bond, because he too saw the attraction of a single person being able to steer their nation out of a hole. But yes, the Burgess, Maclean, and then Philby. Fleming had known Philby in the 30s, and there's a rather sweet salute to Philby in, I think it's Goldfinger, when he talks about Miss Philby, who's the secretary of the Bank of England's women's football team. I don't know how well he knew Philby post-betrayal, but he certainly bumped up against him. And I think, yes, I would say that the betrayal of Burgess and McLean factored largely in the creation of Bond. Who one of Bond's ingredients, when I asked the Broccolis, you know, what wouldn't you tamper with in the character? They say, well, he's got to be English, he's got to be male, he's got to be fighting for Queen, King, and Commonwealth, and he's got to be incorruptible. So that incorruptible element is what Bond restores to the service and to what it is to be English. I mean, I think one of the great achievements of Bond is that he becomes a shorthand for all the English like about themselves, even, and all foreigners like about the English. And so it's a very successful kind of advertisement for what it is to be English. And I talked to the ex-head of MI6, Richard Dearlove, who told me that even though it's all kind of phony, a reflection of what the service is really like, it's why certain Russian defectors are attracted to defecting to the British Secret Service rather than the American Secret Service, because they have this image through Fleming of what the British Secret Service is like, even if it isn't like that in actuality.
You pointed out before that there's no long goodbye for Fleming. He dies very early. And in some ways, as you show, he's haunted in many ways by the creation of Bond. He keeps smoking and drinking even after his first heart attack. Some of his friends think that he had a death wish. So, you know, in many ways, the success comes, but it comes at a price for him.
One thing that stuck in my head for many years is a charade that Evelyn Waugh did after Fleming died in 1964. About 3 weeks later, in the Waugh household, it was the custom of them to do charades before they go back to school. I'd done some documentaries on Evelyn Waugh, and I interviewed the children, and they said, oh my God, it was so wonderful. Our father did the best ever charade of the death of Ian Fleming. And I said, well, what was the charade? Waugh had to perform the word bondsman. And so he got in his dinner jacket onto the carpet, and he enacted the life of Ian Fleming in the following way. He had Ian suddenly having a great idea that would make him lots of money and going down on his knees before an invisible Anne Fleming, who he married, saying, I've got this great idea to make money. And then it makes him a lot of money, but the creation, a bit like Frankenstein, many people say it's a Frankenstein type story, ends up kind of strangling and suffocating. And apparently this whole charade ends with Evelyn Waugh railing on the carpet, grabbing his throat, strangling his own throat and kind of gurgling. And apparently it was just the best performance he'd ever given, the death scene of Ian Fleming. But I think there's a truth in it. I think he does create this machine that he has to feed every year that gets bigger and bigger. He's putting all his energies into creating this book, this series. Every year he goes out to Jamaica for 2 months. He writes it in 2 months. It's then edited and comes out the following April. And I think it takes a lot out of him. He's putting into the books the bullion of secret bullion that he gathered from the Second World War. He couldn't talk about this in the open, but he could disguise it in fiction. So all the books are based on secret operations he was in charge of or knew about, which he wasn't allowed to write about, but he could convert it into fiction against a Cold War enemy, the Russians, rather than the Nazis, which is what the original enemy was. But I think the bullion runs out, his secret goal towards the end, and it's a cost to him. I think, as you say, he's smoking 70 a day, he's drinking 3/4 of a bottle of gin, he's having atrial fibrillations that he can't treat, and suddenly he's becoming one of the world's most successful authors, and he can't enjoy it. He says he'd give up all the success for a healthy heart. In fact, one of the lovely stories in this book of one of the people who knew him was Algy Clough, who had been a young officer at age 22, and he sat next to Fleming at Boodle's Club in 1963, I think, at the height of Fleming's fame, when Dr. No had come out and Russian Would Love had come out. And, you know, crowds are queuing up around the square, Leicester Square, to see the films. And Algy Clough says to Fleming, you must love all this publicity. This must be wonderful. And Fleming said, no, it's not what I want at all. And Clough says, well, what is it you want? And Fleming says, quite seriously, I'd like to be the captain general of the Royal St. George's Golf Club. This really was his ambition. And one of the sadness, or the opposite sadnesses of his story, is that on Saturday, August the 8th, that they all meet at the golf club to appoint Ian Fleming as the captain designate. And so for 2 or 3 days, he knows he's going to be the head of the Royal St. George's Golf Club for the following year. But he dies on August the 12th, the day of his son's birthday. And he never comes to be head of the golf club. But that was his ultimate ambition.
What about the books today? There's a new edition of the novels out with changes to the language. Should listeners read the new edition, or should they go back to Fleming's original, from the originals from the 50s and 60s?
Personally, I'm totally against tampering with other people's texts. I mean, no one reads Bowdler's Shakespeare today, which was done out of the same attempt to kind of rush over people's sensitivities. I think you read Bond to be shocked. You read Bond to be excited. You read Bond to be appalled. Who is it of us who can stop people being appalled or excited? And what we're appalled and excited by today will be a different thing in 10 years' time. So are we going to change the books again in 10 years' time when we've decided something else upsets us? I'm totally against it. And I think most authors would be totally against it. I have no idea why they're doing it. It's for you to ask them. But I think always you should go back to the original, and you should realize that he wouldn't write these things today that would offend you. They were written in a particular time, and I think you infantilize people if you think they don't understand that.
So the book is Ian Fleming, The Complete Man. It's written by my guest, Nicholas Shakespeare, and published by Harper. But for now, Nicholas, congratulations again, and thanks for joining us on Bookstack.
Thank you very much for having me.
So that's it from us this week. Don't forget to check our website, AmericanPurpose.com, and to leave us a review on your podcast app. The show is produced by Laura Silverman, and this is me, Richard Aldous, saying thanks for listening.